85-year-old men are diagnosed with an average of 4 different diseases, with women of that age suffering from 5. Heart disease and cancer, arthritis and Alzheimer's, kidney disease and diabetes. Most patients have several additional undiagnosed diseases, including hypertension, ischemic heart disease, atrial fibrillation, and dementia. Yes, these are different ailments with different pathologies, studied in different buildings at the National Institutes of Health and in different departments within universities. But aging is a risk factor for all of them. In fact, it's the risk factor. Truly, by comparison, little else matters. The final years of my mother's life serve as a good example. Like almost everyone else, I recognized that smoking would increase my mother's chances of getting lung cancer. I also knew why. Cigarette smoke contains a chemical called benzoapyrene, which binds to guanine in DNA, induces double-strand breaks, and causes mutations. The repair process also causes epigenetic drift and metabolic changes that cancer cells thrive on, in a process we've called geroncogenesis. The combination of genetic and epigenetic changes induced by years of exposure to cigarette smoke increases the chances of developing lung cancer about 5-fold. That's a big increase, and because of it, and the devastatingly high health costs associated with treating cancer, the majority of the world's nations sponsor smoking cessation programs. Most countries also put health warnings on cigarette packaging, some with horrific color pictures of tumors and blackened extremities. Most countries have passed laws against certain kinds of tobacco advertising, and most have sought to decrease consumption through punitive taxes. All of that to prevent a 5-fold increase in a few kinds of cancer. And having watched my mother suffer from that kind of cancer, I'll be the first to say it's totally worth it. From both an economic and emotional point of view, these are good investments. But consider this. Though smoking increases the risk of getting cancer 5-fold, being 50 years old increases your cancer risk 100-fold. By the age of 70, it's 1,000-fold. Such exponentially increasing odds also apply to heart disease and diabetes and dementia. The list goes on and on, yet there is not a country in the world that has committed any significant resources to help its citizens combat aging. In a world in which we seem to agree on very little, the feeling that it's just the way it goes is almost universal. A glorious fight. Aging results in physical decline. It limits the quality of life, and it has a specific pathology. Aging does all this, and in doing so, it fulfills every category of what we call a disease, except one. It impacts more than half the population. According to the Merck Manual of Geriatrics, a malady that impacts less than half the population is a disease. But aging, of course, impacts everyone. The manual therefore calls aging an inevitable, irreversible decline in organ function that occurs over time, even in the absence of injury, illness, environmental risks, or poor lifestyle choices. Can you imagine saying that cancer is inevitable and irreversible, or diabetes or gangrene? I can, because we used to say that. All of these may be natural problems, but that doesn't make them inevitable or irreversible, and it sure doesn't make them acceptable. The manual is wrong about aging. But being wrong has never stopped conventional wisdom from negatively impacting public policy. And because aging isn't a disease by the commonly accepted definition, it doesn't fit nicely into the system we've built for funding medical research, drug development, and the reimbursement of medical costs by insurance companies. Words matter. Definitions matter. Framing matters. And the words, definitions, and framing we use to describe aging are all about inevitability. We didn't just throw in the towel before the fight began. We threw it in before we even knew there was a fight to be had. But there is a fight, a glorious and global one, and, I think, a winnable one. There's no good reason why we have to say that something that happens to 49.9% of the population is a disease, while something that happens to 50.1% of the population is not. In fact, that's a backward way of approaching problems that lends itself to the whack-a-mole system of medicine we've set up in hospitals and research centers around the world. Why would we choose to focus on problems that impact small groups of people if we could address the problem that impacts everyone, especially if, in doing so, we could significantly impact all those other smaller problems. We can. I believe that aging is a disease. I believe it is treatable. I believe we can treat it within our lifetimes. And in doing so, I believe, everything we know about human health will be fundamentally changed. If you are not yet convinced that aging is a disease, I want to let you in on a secret. I have a window into the future. In 2028, a scientist will discover a new virus called Line 1. It will turn out that we are all infected with it. We get it from our parents. It will turn out that the Line 1 virus is responsible for most other major diseases: diabetes, heart disease, cancer, dementia. It causes a slow, horrible, chronic disorder, and all humans eventually succumb to it, even if they have a low-grade infection. Fortunately, the world pours billions of dollars into finding a cure. In 2033, a company will succeed in making a vaccine that prevents Line 1 infections. New generations who are vaccinated at birth will live 50 years longer than their parents did. It will turn out that that's our natural lifespan, and we had no idea. The new generation of healthy humans will pity previous generations who blindly accepted that physical decline at 50 was natural and an 80-year life was a life well lived. Of course, this is a science fiction story I just invented, but it might be truer than you think. A few recent studies have suggested that the so-called selfish genes we all carry in our genome, actually called Line 1 elements, replicate and cause cellular havoc as we get older, accelerating our physical demise. We'll discuss them in more detail later, but for now, it's the idea I want to focus on because it raises important questions. Does it matter whether Line 1 comes from your parents directly or via a virus? Would you want to eradicate Line 1 from humanity or let it grow in your kids and inflict horrible diseases on them? Would you say that Line 1 causes a disease or not? If not, is it simply because more than half of all people carry it? Whether it's a virus, a selfish DNA element, or simply the makeup of our cells that causes these health problems, what's the difference? The end result is the same. The belief that aging is a natural process is deep-rooted. So even if I've somewhat convinced you that aging should be considered a disease, let's do another thought experiment. Imagine that everyone on our planet typically lives to 150 years in good health. Your family, though, doesn't. You become wrinkled, gray-haired, diabetic and frail at 80. Upon seeing these poor, unfortunate souls in this poor, unfortunate state of existence, what doctor would not diagnose your family with the disease, name it after him or herself, and publish horrid photos of you with your eyes blacked out in medical journals? Communities would raise money to understand and find a cure for your family's wretched inheritance. That was exactly what happened when the German physician Otto Werner first described a condition that causes people to look and feel as though they're 80 when they're in their 40s. That's Werner syndrome, the disease I was studying when I first arrived at MIT in the 1990s. Nobody said I was studying something that is inevitable or irreversible. Nobody said it was crazy to call Werner syndrome a disease or to work to find a breakthrough therapy. Nobody told me or the Werner patients that that's just the way it goes. In front of us is the deadliest and costliest disease on the planet, a disease that almost no one is working on. It is as if the planet is in a stupor. If your first thought is, "But I don't want to live past 90," let me assure you, I don't want you to live a year longer than you wish. But before you make your decision, let's do one final thought experiment. Imagine that a clerk at City Hall has found a mistake on your birth certificate. It turns out that you are actually 92 years old. "You'll get a new one in the mail," the clerk says. "Have a nice day." Do you feel any different now that you are 92? Nothing else has changed in your life, just a few numbers on your identification. Do you suddenly want to kill yourself? Of course not. When we stay healthy and vibrant, as long as we feel young physically and mentally, our age doesn't matter. That's true whether you are 32, 52 or 92. Most middle-aged and older adults in the United States report feeling 10 to 20 years younger than their age because they still feel healthy. And feeling younger than your age predicts lower mortality and better cognitive abilities later in life. It's a virtuous cycle, as long as you keep pedaling. But no matter how you feel at this moment in your life, even with a positive outlook and a healthy lifestyle, you have a disease, and it's going to catch up to you sooner rather than later unless something is done. I acknowledge that calling aging a disease is a radical departure from the mainstream view of health and well-being, which has established an array of medical interventions addressing the various causes of death. That framework evolved, however, largely because we didn't understand why aging occurs. Up until very recently, the best thing we had was a list of aging hallmarks. The information theory of aging could change that. There's nothing wrong with using the hallmarks to guide interventions. We can probably have a positive impact on people's lives by addressing each of them. It's possible that interventions aimed at slowing telomere deterioration will improve people's long-term well-being. Maintaining proteostasis, preventing deregulation of nutrient sensing, thwarting mitochondrial dysfunction, stopping senescence, rejuvenating stem cells, and decreasing inflammation might all be ways to delay the inevitable. Indeed, I work with students, postdocs, and companies around the globe that are developing solutions to each one of these hallmarks and hope to continue. Anything we can do to alleviate suffering, we should do. But we're still building 9 dams on 9 tributaries. In coming together to tackle the new science of aging, as the attendees of the Royal Society meeting termed this fight in their 2010 meeting, increasing numbers of scientists are starting to acknowledge the possibility and potential inherent in heading upstream. Together, we can build a single dam at the source, not just intervene when things go wrong, not just slow things down. We can eliminate the symptoms of aging altogether. This disease is treatable.
Hey, David, when we wrote Chapter 3, there wasn't a country in the world where aging is considered a disease. And to my knowledge, that hasn't changed yet. I was wondering, though, what movement are you seeing toward countries embracing that definition?
One of the big things that happened while we were writing the book was the World Health Organization declared aging a medical condition, and they put it in their book. That was a big change. Since then, a lot of countries have reached out to talk to me and also to my colleagues about what should we be thinking about in terms of the future. It ranges from, should we be classifying aging as a treatable condition, which I think, as all readers or listeners will hear in the book, is something that I'm very passionate about. So we're talking more and more to countries, a number around the world. Plus, we're also looking at economic modeling of what the future will look like. And note that I don't say if, I say when these drugs will become available and people will start to live healthy lives into their 80s and 90s. What does that do for the economy, for families, for individuals, for politics? And that's something listeners will hear later on in the book.
Is there one country that is further along than the others when it comes to integrating this idea that aging is a treatable condition? Is there a person who's ahead in the race?
There's a few in the lead. So most countries in the world don't even know that aging is a thing yet. They just accept it as natural and something they can never do anything about. There are 5 countries around the world that are leading the charge. Most countries are not thinking about this, but 5 of them, the US would be the first and the leader. For many years, they've been talking at the governmental level about changing the regulations of definition of aging. If they do that, you might be able to go to your doctor and have a pill or an injection that would slow down aging. We think that there are technologies already that could do that. And other countries that are closely behind, Australia, Israel, Singapore, and the UK. And those are the 5 ones that are actively talking about this at the grassroots level, at the academic level, and politicians as well.
You know, one of the things I've found myself discussing with people lately is the idea that if any of these countries embrace the concept that aging is a treatable condition and they attack aging, you don't actually have to make a huge jump to have a huge effect. You don't have to stop aging. You don't have to reverse aging. What I mean is that if we can just slow aging a little bit, we could have a really major effect on pretty much every other chronic disease. If we slow aging, we slow cancer, we slow dementia, we slow heart disease. That would be huge, right?
Well, yeah, it's the biggest thing we could do on the planet to actually help the world's economy and improve lives. That's why I've devoted my life to it. In terms of the economic benefit, it's been estimated that if you just reduced one disease, a major disease, whether it be cancer or heart disease or stroke, by 10%, you'd save a few trillion dollars in the long run for the US. We're talking not just about preventing one disease by 10%, but by all major diseases. So that stacks up very quickly into the tens of trillions of dollars saved. And it could just be by one or two simple pills, some of which we think may exist already. Part 2. What we're learning. The present. 4. Longevity now. Every day I wake up to an inbox full of messages from people from all over the world. The tide ebbs and flows, but always takes the form of a flash flood in the wake of newly announced research from my team or others. What should I be taking? They ask. Can you tell me what I need to do to get admitted into one of the human trials? They implore. Can you extend the lifespan of my daughter's hamster? I kid you not. Some of the letters are much sadder than others. One man recently wrote to offer to contribute a donation to my lab in honor of his mother, who had passed away after suffering terribly through many years of age-related illness. I feel compelled to help, even in some small way, to prevent this from happening to someone else, he wrote. The next day, a woman whose father had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's wrote to ask if there was any way to get him admitted into a study. I would do anything, take him anywhere, spend every last cent I have, she pleaded. He is the only family I have, and I cannot bear the thought of what is about to happen to him. There is great reason for hope on the not-so-distant horizon, but those battling against the ravages of aging right now must do so in a world in which most doctors have never even thought about why we age, let alone how to treat aging. Some of the medical therapies and life-extending technologies discussed in this book are already here. Others are a few years away. And there are more to discuss that are a decade or so down the road. We'll get to those as well. But even without access to this developing technology, no matter who you are, where you live, how old you are, and how much you earn, you can engage your longevity genes starting right now. That's what people have been doing for centuries, without even knowing it, in centenarian-heavy places such as Okinawa, Japan, Nicoya, Costa Rica, and Sardinia, Italy. These are, you might recognize, some of the places the writer Dan Buettner introduced to the world as so-called blue zones starting in the mid-2000s. Since that time, the primary focus for those seeking to apply lessons from these and other longevity hotspots has been on what blue zone residents eat. Ultimately, this resulted in the distillation of longevity diets that are based on the commonalities in the foods eaten in places where there are lots of centenarians. And overwhelmingly, that advice comes down to eating more vegetables, legumes, and whole grains, while consuming less meat, dairy products, and sugar. And that's not a bad place to start. In fact, it's a great place to start. There is widespread disagreement, even among the best nutritionists in the world, as to what constitutes the best diet for Homo sapiens. That's likely because there is no best diet. We're all different enough that our diets need to be subtly and sometimes substantially different too. But we're also all similar enough that there are some very broad commonalities. More veggies and less meat. Fresh food versus processed food. We all know this stuff, though applying it can be a challenge. A big part of the reason that so many people aren't willing to face up to that challenge is because we've always thought of aging as an inevitable part of life. It might come a little earlier for some and a little later for others, but we've always been told that it's coming for us all. That's what we used to say about pneumonia, influenza, tuberculosis, and gastrointestinal conditions too. In 1900, those four illnesses accounted for about half of the deaths in the United States, and if you managed to live long enough, you could be virtually assured that one of them would get you eventually. Today, deaths among people suffering from tuberculosis and gastrointestinal conditions are exceedingly rare. And pneumonia and influenza claim less than 10% of the lives taken by those conditions a little more than a century ago, with most of those deaths now among individuals weakened by aging. What changed? In no small part, it was framing. Advances in medicine, innovations in technology, and better information to guide our lifestyle decisions resulted in a world in which we didn't have to accept the idea that these diseases were just the way it goes. We don't have to accept aging like that either. But even among those who will have the most immediate access to pharmaceuticals and technologies that will be emerging to offer longer and healthier lives in the next few decades, reaching an optimal lifespan and health span won't be as easy as flipping a switch. There will always be good and bad choices, and that starts with what we put into our bodies and what we don't. Go fast. After 25 years of researching aging and having read thousands of scientific papers, if there's one piece of advice I can offer, one surefire way to stay healthy longer, one thing you can do to maximize your lifespan right now, it's this: eat less. This is nothing revolutionary, of course. As far back as Hippocrates, the ancient Greek physician, doctors have been espousing the benefits of limiting what we eat, not just by rejecting the deadly sin of gluttony, as the Christian monk Evagrius Ponticus counseled in the 4th century, but through intentional asceticism. Not malnutrition, not starvation, these are not pathways to more years, let alone better years, but fasting, allowing our bodies to exist in a state of want, more often than most of us allow in our privileged world of plenty, is unquestionably good for our health and longevity. Hippocrates knew this, Ponticus knew this, so too did Luigi Cornaro, a 15th century Venetian nobleman who could, and probably should, be considered the father of the self-help book. The son of an innkeeper, Cornaro made a fortune as an entrepreneur and lavishly spent his money on wine and women. By his mid-30s, he was exhausted by food, drink, and sex, the poor guy, and resolved to limit himself in each regard. The historical record is a bit vague on the details of his sex life after that fateful decision, but his diet and drinking habits have been well documented. He ate no more than 12 ounces of food and drank 2 glasses of wine each day. I accustomed myself to the habit of never fully satisfying my appetite, either with eating or drinking, Cornaro wrote in his first discourse on the temperate life, always leaving the table well able to take more. Cornaro's discourses on the benefits of la vita sobria might have fallen into obscurity had he not provided such compelling personal proof that his advice had merit. He published his guidance when he was in his 80s, and in exceptional health no less, and he died in 1566 at nearly, and some sources say more than, 100 years old. In more recent times, Professor Alexandra Guenyot, the president of the Paris Medical Academy, just after the turn of the 20th century, was famed for living on a restricted diet. It is said that his contemporaries mocked him, for there was no science at that time to back his suspicion that hunger would lead to good health, just his gut hunch. But he outlived them, one and all. He finally succumbed at the age of 102. The first modern scientific explorations of the lifelong effects of a severely restricted diet began during the last days of World War I. That's when longtime biochemical collaborators Lafayette Mendel and Thomas Osborne, the duo who had discovered vitamin A, discovered, along with researcher Edna Ferry, that female rats, whose growth was stunted due to lack of food early in life, lived much longer than those that ate plenty. Picking up on that evidence in 1935, a now famous Cornell University professor named Clive McKay demonstrated that rats fed a diet containing 20% indigestible cellulose, cardboard essentially, lived significantly longer lives than those that were fed a typical lab diet. Studies conducted over the next 80 years demonstrated again and again that calorie restriction without malnutrition, or CR, leads to longevity for all sorts of life forms. Hundreds of mouse studies have been done since to test the effects of calories on health and lifespan, mostly on male mice. Reducing calories works even in yeast. I first noticed this in the late 1990s. Cells fed with lower doses of glucose were living longer, and their DNA was exceptionally compact, significantly delaying the inevitable ERC accumulation, nuclear explosion, and sterility. If this happened only in yeast, it would merely be interesting. But because we knew that rodents also lived longer when their food was restricted, and later learned that this was the case for fruit flies as well, It was apparent that this genetic program was very old, perhaps nearly as old as life itself. In animal studies, the key to engaging the sirtuin program appears to be keeping things on the razor's edge through calorie restriction, just enough food to function in healthy ways and no more. This makes sense. It engages the survival circuit, telling longevity genes to do what they've been doing since primordial times: boost cellular defenses, keep organisms alive during times of adversity, ward off disease and deterioration, minimize epigenetic change, and slow down aging. But this has, for obvious reasons, proven a challenge to test on humans in a controlled scientific setting. Sadly, it's not hard to find instances in which humans have had to go without food, but those periods are generally times in which food insecurity results in malnutrition, and it would be a challenge to keep a test group of humans on the razor's edge for the long periods of time that would be required for comprehensive controlled studies. As far back as the 1970s, though, there have been observational studies that strongly suggested long-term calorie restriction could help humans live longer and healthier lives, too. In 1978, on the island of Okinawa, famed for its large number of centenarians, bioenergetics researcher Yasuo Kagawa learned that the total number of calories consumed by schoolchildren was less than two-thirds of what children were getting in mainland Japan. Adult Okinawans were also leaner, taking in about 20% fewer calories than their mainland counterparts. Kagawa noted that not only were the lifespans of Okinawans longer, but their health spans were too, with significantly less cerebral vascular disease, malignancy, and heart disease. In the early 1990s, the Biosphere 2 research experiment provided another piece of evidence. For 2 years, from 1991 to 1993, 8 people lived inside a 3-acre, closed ecological dome in southern Arizona, where they were expected to be reliant on the food they were growing inside. Green thumbs they weren't, though, and the food they farmed turned out to be insufficient to keep the participants on a typical diet. The lack of food wasn't bad enough to result in malnutrition, but it did mean that the team members were frequently hungry. One of the prisoners, and by prisoners I mean experimental subjects, happened to be Roy Walford, a researcher from California whose studies on extending life in mice are still required reading for scientists entering the aging field. I have no reason to suspect that Walford sabotaged the crops, but the coincidence was rather fortuitous for his research. It gave him an opportunity to test his mouse-based findings on human subjects. Because they were thoroughly medically monitored before, during, and after their 2-year stint inside the dome, the participants gave Walford and other researchers a unique opportunity to observe the numerous biological effects of calorie restriction. Tellingly, the biochemical changes they saw in their bodies closely mirrored those Walford had seen in his long-lived calorie-restricted mice, such as decreased body mass, 15 to 20%, blood pressure, 25%, blood sugar level, 21%, and cholesterol levels, 30%, among others. In recent years, formal human studies have begun, but it has turned out to be quite difficult to get volunteer human subjects to reduce their food intake and maintain that level of consumption over long periods. As my colleagues Leonie Heilbronn and Eric Ravison wrote in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition in 2003, the absence of adequate information on the effects of good quality, calorie-restricted diets in non-obese humans reflects the difficulties involved in conducting long-term studies in an environment so conducive to overfeeding. Such studies in free-living persons also raise ethical and methodologic issues. In a report published in the Journals of Gerontology in 2017, a Duke University research team described how it sought to limit 145 adults to a diet of 25% fewer calories than is typically recommended for a healthy lifestyle. People being people, the actual calorie restriction achieved was, on average, about 12% over 2 years. Even that was enough, however, for the scientists to see significant improvements in health and a slowdown in biological aging based on changes in blood biomarkers. These days, there are many people who have embraced a lifestyle that permits significantly reduced caloric intake. About a decade ago, before fasting's most recent revival, some of them visited my lab at Harvard. "Isn't it hard to do what you do?" I asked Meredith Averill and her husband Paul McLaughlin, at the time members of CR Society International, and still very much advocates for calorie restriction, who limit themselves to about 75% of the calories typically recommended by doctors, and sometimes quite a bit less than that. Don't you just feel hungry all the time? Sure, at first, McLaughlin told me, but you get used to it. We feel great. At lunch that day, McLaughlin expounded upon the merits of eating organic baby food and slurped down something that looked to me like orange mush. I also noticed that both he and Averill were wearing turtlenecks. It wasn't winter, and most folks in my lab are perfectly comfortable in t-shirts. But with so little fat on their bodies, they needed the extra warmth. Then, in his late 60s, McLaughlin showed no signs that his diet might slow him down. He was the CEO of a successful marketing company and a former New York State chess champion. He didn't look much younger than his age, though. In large part, I suspect this was because a lack of fat exposes wrinkles, but his blood biochemistry suggested otherwise. On his 70th birthday, his health indicators, from blood pressure and LDL cholesterol to resting heart rate and visual acuity, were typical of those of a much younger person. Indeed, they resembled those seen in the long-lived rats on calorie restriction. It's true that what we know about the impact of lifelong calorie restriction in humans comes down to short-term studies and anecdotal experiences. But one of our close relatives has offered us insights into the longitudinal benefits of this lifestyle. Since the 1980s, a long-term study of calorie restriction in rhesus monkeys, our close genetic cousins, has produced stunningly compelling results. Before the study, the maximum known lifespan for any rhesus monkey was 40 years. But of 20 monkeys in the study that lived on calorie-restricted diets, 6 reached that age, which is roughly equivalent to their reaching 120 in human terms. To hit that mark, the monkeys didn't need to live on a calorie-restricted diet for their entire lives. Some of the test subjects were started on a 30% reduction regimen when they were middle-aged monkeys. CR works to extend the lifespan of mice, even when initiated at 19 months of age, the equivalent of a 60 to 65-year-old human. But the earlier the mice start on CR, the greater the lifespan extension. What these and other animal studies tell us is that it's hard to age out of the longevity benefits of calorie restriction, but it's probably better to start earlier than later, perhaps after age 40, when things really start to go downhill, molecularly speaking. That doesn't make a CR diet a good plan for everyone. Indeed, even Rosalind Anderson, a former trainee of mine, who's now a famous professor at the University of Wisconsin and a lead researcher in the rhesus study, says that a 30% calorie-reduced diet for humans long-term amounted in her mind to a bonkers diet. It's certainly not bonkers for everyone, though, especially considering that calorie restriction hasn't been demonstrated only to lengthen life, but also to forestall cardiac disease, diabetes, stroke, and cancer. It's not just a longevity plan, it's a vitality plan. It's nonetheless a hard sell for many people. It takes strong willpower to avoid the fridge at home or snacks at work. There's an adage in my field: if calorie restriction doesn't make you live longer, it will certainly make you feel that way. But it turns out that's okay, because research is increasingly demonstrating that many of the benefits of a life of strict and uncompromising calorie restriction can be obtained in another way. In fact, that way might be even better. The periodic table. To ensure a genetic response to a lack of food, hunger doesn't need to be the status quo. Once we've grown accustomed to stress, after all, it's no longer as stressful. Intermittent fasting, or IF, eating normal portions of food but with periodic episodes without meals, is often portrayed as a new innovation in health. But long before my friend Volta Longo at the University of California, Los Angeles, began touting the benefits of IF, scientists had been studying the effects of periodic calorie restriction for the better part of a century. In 1946, University of Chicago researchers Anton Carlson and Frederick Herzl subjected rats to periodic food restriction and found, when they did, that those that went hungry every third day lived 15 to 20% longer than their cousins on a regular diet. At the time, it was believed that fasting provided the body with a rest. That's very much the opposite of what we now know about what happens at the cellular level when we subject our bodies to the stress of going without food. Either way, Carlson and Herzl's work provided valuable information on the long-term results of irregular calorie restriction. It's not clear whether the pair applied what they'd learned to their own lives, but both lived relatively long lives for their time. Carlson died at the age of 81. Herzl made it to 74, despite having subjected himself over the years to experiments that included swallowing gravel, glass beads, and ball bearings to study how long it would take for such objects to pass through his system. And people say I'm crazy. Today, human studies are confirming that once in a while calorie restriction can have tremendous health results, even if the times of fasting are quite transient. In one such study, participants ate a normal diet most of the time, but turned to a significantly restricted diet consisting primarily of vegetable soup, energy bars, and supplements for 5 days each month. Over the course of just 3 months, those who maintained the fasting-mimicking diet lost weight, reduced their body fat, and lowered their blood pressure too. Perhaps most important, though, the participants had lower levels of a hormone made primarily in the liver called insulin-like growth factor 1, or IGF-1. Mutations in IGF-1 and the IGF-1 receptor gene are associated with lower rates of death and disease and found in abundance in females whose families tend to live past 100. Levels of IGF-1 have been closely linked to longevity. The impact is so strong, in fact, that in some cases it can be used to predict with great accuracy how long someone will live, according to Neil Barzilai and Yuxin Su, who research aging at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine at Yeshiva University in New York. Barzilai and Su are geneticists whose research focuses on centenarians who've made it to 100 and beyond without suffering from any age-related diseases. That unique population is a vital study group because its members provide a model for aging the way most people say they want to age, not accepting that additional years of life need to come with additional years of misery. When we find clusters of these people, we see that in some cases, it doesn't actually matter what they put into their bodies. They carry gene variants that seem to put them into a state of fasting no matter what they eat. As anyone who has ever known a centenarian can attest, it doesn't take a lifetime of making 100% healthy decisions to reach 100. When Barzilai's team studied nearly 500 Ashkenazi Jews over the age of 95, they saw that many engaged in the same sorts of behaviors doctors have long been telling us to shun: eating fried foods, smoking, and just sitting around and drinking a little too much. Barzilai once asked one of his centenarian study subjects why she hadn't listened to her doctors over the years when they had strongly advised her to end her lifelong smoking habit. "I've had 4 doctors tell me that smoking would kill me," she said with a wry smile. "And well, all 4 are dead now, aren't they?" Some people are simply winners in the genetic lottery. The rest of us have some extra work to do. But the good news is that the epigenome is malleable. Since it's not digital, it's easier to impact. We can control the behavior of this analog element of our biology by how we live our lives. The important thing is not just what we eat, but the way we eat. As it turns out, there is a strong correlation between fasting behavior and longevity in blue zones, such as Icaria, Greece, the island where people forget to die, where 1/3 of the population lives past the age of 90, and almost every older resident is a staunch disciple of the Greek Orthodox Church and adheres to a religious calendar that calls for some manner of fasting more than half the year. On many days, that means no meat, dairy products, or eggs, and sometimes no wine or olive oil either. For some Greeks, that's just about everything. Additionally, many Greeks observe periods of total fasting before taking Holy Communion. Other longevity hotspots, such as Barma County in southern China, are places where people have access to good healthy food but choose to forego it for long periods each day. Many of the centenarians in this region have spent their lives eschewing a morning meal. They generally eat their first meal of the day around noon, then share a larger meal with their families at twilight. In this way, they typically spend 16 hours or more of each day without eating. When we investigate places like this, and as we seek to apply research about fasting to our modern lives, we find that there are scores of ways to calorie restrict that are sustainable, and many take the form of what has come to be known as periodic fasting, not being hungry all the time, but using hunger some of the time to engage our survival circuit. over time, some of these ways of limiting food will prove to be more effective than others. A popular method is to skip breakfast and have a late lunch, the 16+8 diet. Another is to eat 75% fewer calories for 2 days a week, the 5+2 diet. If you're a bit more adventurous, you can try skipping food a couple of days a week. Eat, stop, eat. Or as the health pundit Peter Attia does, go hungry for an entire week every quarter. The permutations of these various models for extending life and health are being worked out in animals and will be worked out in people too. The short-term studies are promising. I suspect the long-term research will be too. In the meantime, however, almost any periodic fasting diet that does not result in malnutrition is likely to put your longevity genes to work in ways that will result in a longer, healthier life. It doesn't take any money to eat this way. In fact, it saves money. Moreover, people who are not accustomed to being able to gorge themselves whenever they want might be in a better position to be successful at going a few days each month with a lot less food. At least at this juncture in the evolution of our customs around food, though, for many people, any form of fasting is a non-starter. I've tried calorie restriction. I can't do it. Feeling hungry isn't fun, and food is just too pleasurable. Lately, I've taken to periodic fasting, skipping a meal or two each day, but I admit that it's mostly unintentional. I simply forget to eat. So far, though, we've talked only about engaging the survival circuit by limiting how much we eat, but what we eat is also important. Amino right. We die quite quickly without amino acids, the organic compounds that serve as the building blocks for every protein in the human body. Without them, and in particular the 9 essential amino acids that our bodies cannot make on their own, our cells can't assemble the life-giving enzymes needed for life. Meat contains all 9 of the essential amino acids. That's easy energy, but it doesn't come without a cost. Actually, a lot of costs. Because no matter how you feel about the morals of the matter, meat is murder on our bodies. So can we just avoid protein? Ironically, protein is what satiates us. Same for mice, same for swarming locusts in need of nutrients, which is why they eat each other. It would appear that animal life can't easily limit protein in the diet without some hunger pains. There isn't much debate on the downsides of consumption of animal protein. Study after study has demonstrated that heavily animal-based diets are associated with high cardiovascular mortality and cancer risk. Processed red meats are especially bad. Hot dogs, sausage, ham, and bacon might be gloriously delicious, but they're ingloriously carcinogenic, according to hundreds of studies that have demonstrated a link between these foods and colorectal, pancreatic, and prostate cancer. Red meat also contains carnitine, which gut bacteria convert to trimethylamine N-oxide, or TMAO, a chemical that is suspected of causing heart disease. That doesn't mean a little red meat will kill you. The diet of hunter-gatherers is a mix of plants packed with fiber and nutrients, mixed with some red meat and fish in moderation. But if you're interested in a long and healthy life, your diet probably needs to look a lot more like a rabbit's lunch than a lion's dinner. When we substitute animal protein with more plant protein, studies have shown all-cause mortality falls significantly. From an energy perspective, the good news is that there isn't a single amino acid that can't be obtained by consuming plant-based protein sources. The bad news is that, unlike most meats, weight for weight, any given plant usually delivers limited amounts of amino acids. From a vitality perspective, though, that's great news, because a body that is in short supply of amino acids overall, or any single amino acid for a spell, is a body under the very sort of stress that engages our survival circuits. You'll recall that when the enzyme known as mTOR is inhibited, it forces cells to spend less energy dividing and more energy in the process of autophagy, which recycles damaged and misfolded proteins. That act of hunkering down ends up being good for prolonged vitality in every organism we've studied. What we're coming to learn is that mTOR isn't impacted only by caloric restriction. If you want to keep mTOR from being activated too much or too often, limiting your intake of amino acids is a good way to start. So inhibiting this particular longevity gene is really as simple as limiting your intake of meat and dairy. It's also increasingly clear that all essential amino acids aren't equal. Rafael DeCarbo at the National Institutes of Health Richard Miller at the University of Michigan and Jay Mitchell at Harvard Medical School have found over the years that feeding mice a diet with low levels of the amino acid methionine works particularly well to turn on their bodily defenses, to protect organs from hypoxia during surgery, and to increase healthy lifespan by 20%. One of my former students, Dudley Lamming, who now runs a lab at the University of Wisconsin, demonstrated that methionine restriction causes obese mice to shed most of their fat and fast, even as the mice, which Lamming called couch potatoes, continued to eat as much as they wanted and shun exercise, they still lost about 70% of their fat in a month, while also lowering their blood glucose levels. We can't live without methionine, but we can do a better job of restricting the amount of it we put into our bodies. There's a lot of methionine in beef, lamb, poultry, pork, and eggs, whereas plant proteins in general tend to contain low levels of that amino acid, enough to keep the light on, as it were, but not enough to let the biological complacency set in. The same is true for arginine and the three branched chain amino acids, leucine, isoleucine, and valine, all of which can activate mTOR. Low levels of these amino acids correlate with increased lifespan, and in human studies, a decreased consumption of branched chain amino acids has been shown to improve markers of metabolic health significantly. We can't live without them, but most of us can definitely stand to get less of them. And we can do that by lowering our consumption of foods that many people consider to be the good animal proteins, chicken, fish, and eggs, particularly when those foods aren't being used to recover from physical stress or injury. All of this might seem counterintuitive. Amino acids, after all, are often considered helpful, and they can be. Leucine, for instance, is well known to boost muscle, which is why it's found in large quantities in the protein drinks that bodybuilders often chug before, during, and after workouts. But that muscle building is coming in part because leucine is activating mTOR, which essentially calls out to your body, times are good right now, let's disengage the survival circuit. In the long run, however, protein drinks may be preventing the mTOR pathway from providing its longevity benefits. Studies in which leucine is completely eliminated from a mouse's diet have demonstrated that just 1 week without this particular amino acid significantly reduces blood glucose levels, a key marker of improved health. So a little leucine is necessary, of course, but a little goes a long way. All of these findings may explain why vegetarians suffer significantly lower rates of cardiovascular disease and cancer than meat eaters. The reduction of amino acids, and thus the inhibition of mTOR, isn't the only thing at play in that equation. The lower calorie content, increased polyphenols, and feeling of superiority over your fellow human beings are also helpful. All of these, except the last, are valid explanations for why vegetarians live longer and stay healthier. If we eat a low-protein, vegetable-rich diet, we may live longer, but we won't maximize our lifespans, because putting our bodies into nutritional adversity isn't going to maximally trigger our longevity genes. We need to induce some physical adversity too. If that doesn't happen, we miss a key opportunity to trigger our survival circuits further. Like a beautiful sports car driven only a block and back on Sunday mornings, our longevity genes will go tragically underutilized. With so much horsepower under the hood, we just have to fire up the engine and take it out for a spin. Do sweat it. There's a reason why for centuries exercise has been the go-to prescription for vitality. But that reason isn't what most people, or even many doctors, think. In the nearly 400 years since the English physician William Harvey discovered that blood flows around the body in an intricate network of tubes, doctors thought that exercise improves health by moving blood through the circulatory system faster, flushing out the buildup of plaque. That's not how it works. Yes, exercise improves blood flow. Yes, it improves lung and heart health. Yes, it gives us bigger, stronger muscles. But more than any of that, and indeed what is responsible for much of that, is a simple thing that happens at a much smaller scale, the cellular scale. When researchers studied the telomeres in the blood cells of thousands of adults with all sorts of different exercise habits, they saw a striking correlation. Those who exercised more had longer telomeres. And according to one study funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and published in 2017, individuals who exercise more, the equivalent of at least half an hour of jogging 5 days a week, have telomeres that appear to be nearly a decade younger than those who live a more sedentary life. But why would exercising delay the erosion of telomeres? If you think about how our longevity genes work, employing those ancient survival circuits, this all makes sense. Limiting food intake and reducing the heavy load of amino acids in most diets aren't the only ways to activate longevity genes that order our cells to shift into survival mode. Exercise, by definition, is the application of stress to our bodies. It raises NAD levels, which in turn activates the survival network, which turns up energy production and forces muscles to grow extra oxygen-carrying capillaries. The longevity regulators, AMPK, mTOR, and sirtuins, are all modulated in the right direction by exercise, irrespective of caloric intake, building new blood vessels, improving heart and lung health, making people stronger, and yes, extending telomeres. SIRT1 and SIRT6, for example, help extend telomeres, then package them up so they are protected from degradation. Because it's not the absence of food or any particular nutrient that puts these genes into action. Instead, it is the hormesis program, governed by the survival circuit, the mild kind of adversity that wakes up and mobilizes cellular defenses without causing too much havoc. There's really no way around this. We all need to be pushing ourselves, especially as we get older. Yet only 10% of people over the age of 65 do. The good news is that we don't have to exercise for hours on end. One recent study found that those who ran 4 to 5 miles a week, for most people, that's an amount of exercise that can be done in less than 15 minutes a day, reduced their chance of death from a heart attack by 40% and all-cause mortality by 45%. That's a massive effect. In another study, researchers reviewed the medical records of more than 55,000 people and cross-referenced those documents with death certificates issued over 15 years. Among 3,500 deaths, they weren't particularly surprised to see that those who had told their doctors they were runners were far less likely to die of heart disease. Even when the researchers adjusted for obesity and smoking, the runners were less likely to have died during the years of the study. The big shock was that the health benefits were remarkably similar, no matter how much running the people had done. Even about 10 minutes of moderate exercise a day added years to their lives. There is a difference between a leisurely walk and a brisk run, however. To engage our longevity genes fully, intensity does matter. Mayo Clinic researchers studying the effects of different types of exercise on different age groups found that although many forms of exercise have positive health effects, it's high-intensity interval training, HIIT or HIIT, the sort that significantly raises your heart and respiration rates, that engages the greatest number of health-promoting genes and more of them in older exercisers. You'll know you're doing vigorous activity when it feels challenging. Your breathing should be deep and rapid at 70 to 85% of your maximum heart rate. You should sweat and be unable to say more than a few words without pausing for breath. This is the hypoxic response, and it's great for inducing just enough stress to activate your body's defenses against aging without doing permanent harm. We're still working to understand what all of the longevity genes do, but one thing is already clear. Many of the longevity genes that are turned on by exercise are responsible for the health benefits of exercise, such as extending telomeres, growing new microvessels that deliver oxygen to cells, and boosting the activity of mitochondria, which burn oxygen to make chemical energy. We've known for a long time that these bodily activities fall as we age. What we also know now is that the genes most impacted by exercise-induced stress can bring them back to the levels associated with youth. In other words, exercise turns on the genes to make us young again, at a cellular level. Often I'm asked, can I just eat what I want and run off the extra calories? My answer is unlikely. When you give rats a high-calorie diet and allow them to burn off the energy, lifespan extension is minimal. Same for a CR diet. If you make food filling but not as calorific, some of the health benefits are lost. Being hungry is necessary for CR to work because hunger helps turn on the genes in the brain that release longevity hormones, at least according to a recent study by Dongshen Ke at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Would a combination of fasting and exercise lengthen your lifespan? Absolutely. If you manage to do both these things, congratulations, you're well on your way. But there's plenty more you can do. The cold front. Before arriving in Boston in my early 20s, I'd spent my whole life in Australia. Culturally, everything worked out just fine. Within a week, I'd figured out which markets carried Vegemite, the black yeast spread that some might say requires some pretty significant epigenetic programming as a child to enjoy as an adult. It took a bit longer to track down the best places for meat pies, violet crumble, Tim Tams and musk sticks. But eventually, I figured out how to get all of those tastes of home too. And it didn't take long before I stopped caring that folks in the United States seem to have a hard time differentiating between Australian and British accents. It's not that hard. Aussie accents are sexier. The toughest part was the cold. As a boy, I thought I knew what cold was. When the temperature at Observatory Hill, Sydney's official weather station for more than a century, approached freezing, it hasn't actually fallen below freezing in modern history, that was cold. Boston was a whole different world, a really frigid one. I invested in coats, sweaters, and long underwear and spent a lot of time indoors. Like a lot of postdoctoral fellows, I often worked through the night. I was truly committed to my work, but the truth is that part of the calculus for not going home on many nights was that I didn't want to go outside. These days, I wish I'd taken a different approach. I wish I'd just told myself to tough it out, to take a walk in the bitter cold, to dip my toes into the Charles River in the middle of January. Because, as it turns out, exposing your body to less than comfortable temperatures is another very effective way to turn on your longevity genes. When the world takes us out of the thermoneutral zone, the small range of temperatures that don't require our bodies to do any extra work to stay warm or cool off, all sorts of things happen. Our breathing pattern shifts. The blood flow to and through our skin, the largest organ in the body, changes. Our heart rates speed up or slow down. These reactions aren't happening just because. All of these reactions have genetic roots, dating back to M. Superstes' fight for survival all those billions of years ago. Homeostasis, the tendency for living things to seek a stable equilibrium, is a universal biological principle. Indeed, it is the guiding force of the survival circuit, and thus we see it everywhere we look, especially on the low end of the thermometer. As scientists have increasingly turned their attention to the impacts of reduced food intake on the human body, it has quickly become clear that calorie restriction has the effect of reducing core body temperature. It wasn't at first clear whether this contributed to prolonged vitality or was simply a byproduct of all the changes happening in the bodies of organisms exposed to this particular sort of stress. Back in 2006, though, a team from the Scripps Research Institute genetically engineered some lab mice to live their lives half a degree cooler than normal, a feat they accomplished by playing a trick on the mice's biological thermostat. The team inserted copies of the mouse UCP2 gene into the mice's hypothalamus, which regulates the skin, sweat glands, and blood vessels. UCP2 short-circuited mitochondria in the hypothalamus, so they produced less energy but more heat. That, in turn, caused the mice to cool down about half a degree Celsius. The result was a 20% longer life for female mice, the equivalent of about 7 additional healthy human years, while male mice got an extension of 12%. The gene involved, which has a human analog, wasn't just a piece of the complex machinery that tricked the hypothalamus into thinking the mice's bodies were warmer than they were. It was also a gene that has been connected time and time again to longevity. 5 years earlier, a joint team of researchers from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Harvard Medical School showed that mice age faster when their UCP2 gene is nullified. And in 2005, Stephen Helfand and his team, then at the University of Connecticut Health Center, had demonstrated that targeted upregulation of an analogous gene could extend the lifespans of fruit flies by 28% in females and 11% in males. Then, in 2017, the connection between the UCP2 gene and aging came full circle, thanks to researchers from Université Laval in Quebec. Not only could UCP2 make mice run cold, the Canadian team demonstrated, but colder temperatures could change the way the gene operated too, through its ability to rev up brown adipose tissue. Also known as brown fat, this mitochondria-rich substance was, until recently, thought to exist only in infants. Now we know that it's found in adults too, although the amount of it decreases as we age. Over time, it becomes harder and harder to find. It mingles with white fat and is spread out even more unevenly across the body. It hangs out in different areas in different people, sometimes in the abdomen, sometimes across the upper back. That makes researching it in humans a bit of a challenge. It generally takes a PET scan, which requires the injection of radioactive glucose to locate it. Rodent studies, however, have provided significant insights into the correlation between brown fat and longevity. One study of genetically engineered Ames dwarf mice, for instance, demonstrated that the function of brown fat is enhanced in these remarkably long-lived animals. Other studies have shown that animals with abundant brown fat, or subjected to shivering cold for 3 hours a day, have much more of the mitochondrial UCP-boosting sirtuin, SIRT3, and experience significantly reduced rates of diabetes, obesity, and Alzheimer's disease. That is why we need to learn more about how to chemically substitute for brown adipose tissue thermogenesis. Chemicals, called mitochondrial uncouplers, can mimic the effects of UCP2, allowing protons to leak through mitochondrial membranes, like drilling holes in a dam at a hydroelectric plant. The result is not cold, but heat as a byproduct of the mitochondrial short circuit. The sweet-smelling mitochondrial uncoupler, called 2,4-dinitrophenol, or DNP, was used for making explosives in the First World War, and it soon became apparent that employees exposed to the chemical were rapidly losing weight, with one employee even dying from overexposure. In 1933, Drs. Winsor Cutting and Morris Tainter from the Stanford University School of Medicine summarized a series of their papers showing that DNP markedly increases metabolic rate. That same year, despite Tainter's and Cutting's warnings about certain potential dangers, 20 companies started selling it in the United States, as did others in Great Britain, France, Sweden, Italy, and Australia. It worked well, too well, in fact. Just 1 year later, speaking before the American Public Health Association, Tainter said, "The interest in and enthusiasm for this product was so great that its widespread use has become a matter of some concern in public health. The total amount of the drug being used is astonishing." Moments later, he dropped a bombshell. "During the past year," he said, "the Stanford clinics have supplied over 1,200,000 capsules of dinitrophenol of 0.1 grams each." Over 1 million capsules? From one university in 1 year? That is astonishing. And that was in 1933, when California had an eighth of its present population. 3 pounds of weight per person per week were reportedly being shed. The public was relieved. Something finally worked. Obesity was going to be a thing of the past. But the metabolic party didn't last long. People began to die from overdoses, and other long-term side effects showed up. DNP was declared extremely dangerous and not fit for human consumption in the United States Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938. As a curious aside, the legislation was written by Senator Royal Copeland, a homeopathic physician who, only days before he died, entrenched protections for natural supplements that today fuel a largely unregulated industry with revenues of $122 billion. The act rightly banned a dangerous substance, but dashed hopes that obesity would be a thing of the past. Anecdotally, DNP continued to be prescribed to Russian soldiers during World War II to keep them warm. And today, some unscrupulous people sell it on the internet, but they do so at their peril. In 2018, Bernard Rebello was sentenced to 7 years in prison for the death of a woman to whom he sold DNP. In the United States, there have been 62 documented deaths since 1918, though there were likely many more than that. One thing is clear: DNP is extremely dangerous. Eating less at each meal, moving more, and focusing on plant-based foods are much safer options. Another thing you can try is activating the mitochondria in your brown fat by being a bit cold. The best way to do this might be the simplest. A brisk walk in a t-shirt on a winter day in a city such as Boston will do the trick. Exercising in the cold in particular appears to turbocharge the creation of brown adipose tissue. Leaving a window open overnight